The talk you are about to hear is by Roshi Amala Wrightson, teacher at the Auckland Zen Center.
Today is Tuesday, the 11th of March, 2025, and our teacher this evening is going to be on attachment and non-attachment. Our teacher, Roshi Bowden, used to say, if you're suffering, there's attachment. So it's like a flag that can point to where we're being attached. In Master Hakon's chant, which we did just now, we recited the line, the cause of our suffering is ego delusion. Attachment to this delusion of self is the theme that runs really through all our attachments. You might think, given the world situation, that it's appropriate to be suffering, given what's happening. Isn't it appropriate to be alarmed at the situation we're in globally? We have a senior advisor to the president saying that the fundamental weakness in Western civilization is empathy. Somebody contrasted this with the words of a chief psychologist, G.M. Gilbert, who interviewed the Nazis who were on trial at Nuremberg. And he said, I told you once that I was searching for the nature of evil. I think I have come close to defining it as a lack of empathy. It's the core characteristic that connects all of the defendants. A genuine incapacity to feel with their fellow man. Evil, I think, is the absence of empathy. We're in a situation where much of the political power in the world is in the hands of individuals with very little or no empathy. And it's important to see that this is an incapacitation, a gross limit on their humanity. It certainly is a cause for alarm and concern, and for us to suffer with those who are in the thick of it. We all, in doing the four vows at the end of our sittings and talks, We're aspiring to walk the way of the bodhisattvas. And the bodhisattvas are attached. They're attached to rescuing sentient beings. We go actually one step past empathy, which is as I understand it, to feel with. We, in the way of the Bodhisattva, we see compassion and wisdom as our primary values, our aspiration. And compassion takes us a step beyond empathy and into action, into a response. I saw this this little piece of a longer discourse that Richard had copied down. It's from the Vegetable Roots Discourse by Hong Zicheng, a Ming Dynasty philosopher. And he says, always leave boiled rice out for the mice, and keep lamps dark out of pity for the moths. The ancients had this sort of concern, and it's really the whole point of life, generation after generation. Without it, one can only be called a blockhead carcass. And of course, if we show this kind of concern for animal life, how much more so we are called upon to concern ourselves with human suffering. It's all of a piece, actually. So we are called on to respond and act. But I think many of us would ask the question, how, in what way? And how can we practice attachment, non-attachment rather, without falling into indifference? Well, the sixth ancestor, Huai Nung, came up with three antidotes to our attachment. These he labeled no thought, no form, and non-abiding. No thought was an antidote to our attachment to our inner world, a world of concepts and ideas and images. No form was an antidote to our attachment to our outer relationships, to people and things. And non-abiding is an antidote to our tendency to attach to our identity. And we're going to have a look at each of these. Reading from Silent Illumination by Guo Gu, which we're taking this text up about where we left off in the last Taisho I gave. And a little bit of introduction first, and then we'll get into these three separate antidotes. Principles. He says, in order to appreciate these three principles, we need to recognize grasping as a deep-seated feeling tone. It's a sense of lack, a thirst for something. Of course, being discontented can bring about change for the better in our lives. But here I'm referring to a habit of possessiveness which arises from self-grasping. And when he talks about possessiveness here, he's implying also the opposite of possession, wanting to possess something, which is wanting to get rid of something or disowning it, aversion, the other side of desire. But as he makes an important point here, he's not just talking about our random attachments to different things, but to this underlying deep-seated feeling tone. It's an emotional impulse which then thoughts get wrapped around it. But he says a sense of lack, a thirst for something, a sense of things not being right, us not being right in some way, in some fundamental way, and then the different ways in which we seek out that thing, which we can define to a certain degree, but maybe not completely, that pulls us through life, really. Huai Nung says, since the past, this teaching of ours has first taken no thought as its principle, no form as its essence, and non-abiding as its foundation. Let me just read those again. They can be very helpful to apply to things that go on in our lives. These three principles: no thought as its principle, no form as its essence, and non-abiding as its foundation. You think of, especially this last one, non-abiding is our foundation. Foundations usually are very solid, but non-abiding suggests something other, something much more fluid. This is Wei Ning continuing. No form is to transcend thought in the midst of thinking. No thought means to transcend thought in the midst of thinking. No form is to transcend form in the context of forms and appearances. Non-abiding is your fundamental nature. All worldly things are empty. So another really important point here when we talk about no thought is we don't mean getting rid of every single thought in our minds, but to be without thought in the midst of thinking. This Guogu continuing. Thoughts, feelings, and narratives are what we grasp internally. Form is what we grasp externally, and this can include our bodies, objects, environments, status, wealth, and appearances. None of these objects of grasping are in and of themselves bad. Another important point. Sometimes they are needed to help us navigate through life and improve our circumstances. So we shouldn't think that it was somehow bad to have thoughts in the minds. We have them because they allow us to function in the world. Imagination would be put in this list. Somebody with no empathy is somebody without an ability to imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes. Incredibly important. But often we don't just have these faculties functioning in us, but we and are helped by them through life, but we cling to them, we reify them into something solid, and this is where problems arise. When our grasping is driven by possessiveness and obsession, it brings about suffering for ourselves and others. Non-abiding is just a Chan way of saying non-grasping. Everything is fluid, changing, open to opportunities. This is how things, including ourselves, are. Nothing is fixed or rigid. How can anything be grasped? Grasping and rejecting are always based on our self-referential obsessions. If we are captivated or repulsed by whatever comes up in our practice, then it gains power over us and the problem becomes worse. When difficulties arise, it is important to see them clearly, accept them, work with them, and let them go. This is a useful little sequence for us to remember. When difficulties arise, it is important to see them clearly. That's nothing can happen before that we actually acknowledge what's going on. So seeing them clearly, work with them, accept them, work with them, and let them go. We'd like to skip all that and go straight to the letting go, and often our impulse is not so much about letting go, but of getting rid of. And that just creates more problems. Any aversion that we apply to what's going on in our lives gives that pattern, that phenomenon, more energy. It's like pushing down on a jack-in-a-box, just comes back stronger. And along with our grasping, there's often a desire to control phenomena. There's so much we can't control, especially in when we look at world events. It doesn't mean there aren't things we can do and respond, but it's a matter of all of us joining together to do that, rather than thinking we have any kind of direct ability to control these things. Guogu says, the opposite of thinking, grasping, and abiding is contentment. And it's the most important of all attitudes to cultivate in order to see our inner experiences and outer relations as our true nature. So he uses contentment and non-attachment interchangeably in here, this text. But I think using the label contentment is helpful because it's got a kind of emotional tone to it, which is helpful. Non-attachment can sound remote, abstract, maybe cold, but contentment, to find a way to work with circumstances, work with difficult people, work with our own difficult emotions. Okay, now we'll look at each of these three antidotes, starting off with no thought. How do we relate to our inner experience? In the platform scripture passage, no thought does not mean cutting off thinking. It means there is no fixation with regard to the free flow of our thinking. We don't need to reify or solidify what we experience into my thoughts, my feelings. Actually, if you examine it, many of our thoughts aren't our possessions. They come from all kinds of other sources, things we've heard, ways we were brought up, attitudes that are taught through different kinds of art forms, cultural forms, contexts we live in. So we call these my thoughts and my feelings, but largely they're not exactly ours. We certainly don't have control over them. If self-grasping is present, then thoughts don't flow. When we suffer, we are caught in the middle of the stories that we're fabricating and, in a way, prolong that suffering. When we're actually not life is not all about us. We're not at the center. We're just one character in a drama, you could say. Ordinarily, our happiness is completely dependent on thoughts, narratives, concepts, and words. So if we have negative, self-disparaging thoughts, and we automatically identify with them, then we will feel very unhappy. If someone praises us and we identify with that, then we will feel very happy. This is quite normal. Unfortunately, when we're tethered to our thoughts, we lose our autonomy. Like a puppet, we are tied up by the strings of our thoughts, completely at the mercy of our narratives. The problem is not with thoughts. The problem is the strings that tie us to those thoughts, our grasping and rejecting. This is what it comes down to. Seeing our thoughts, recognizing them, acknowledging them, seeing the way that we imprison ourselves with them and begin to loosen those strings that tie us up. Here, thought has two levels of meaning. The first refers to our mental activity, our brain's natural ability to think, symbolize, conceptualize, cognize, and perceive. The second level refers to our fixation on our constructs, notions, and storylines. In other words, our tendency to reify ideas and feeling into discrete realities, into things. There is no problem with our natural ability to think, imagine, and so on. The problem is when we start to solidify our thoughts and feelings into fixed notions of me, I, and mine. One of the ways this is characterized in Buddhism, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, is as the eight worldly winds. People of some of you will have heard of this before. The eight worldly winds are fear of pain and desire for pleasure, fear of loss and desire for gain, fear of being blamed and wish to be praised, and a fear of ill repute and desire for fame. So we have these eight, what are called worldly winds, the things that get us, the things that upset us, that knock us off center. And see how they're also paired, pain and pleasure, loss and gain, blame and praise, ill repute and fame. We also turn these into very solid dualities. We reject pain and try and generate as much pleasure as we can, and the same with the others. And this polar way of looking at them is also problematic. To practice contentment, we have to first expose our sense of lack or need to possess something. Don't identify with these subtle feeling tones. At the same time, don't block them either. There are reasons why we feel and think the way we do. Our thoughts and feelings reveal something about us. Recognizing them as they arise and not grasping or rejecting them is itself a way to own and embrace them. When we can allow ourselves to be with them, we can start to work with them, to work through them and to let go of them, which means they no longer have a strong hold over us. What he's describing is a process that is undertaken when you do acceptance and commitment therapy. It's called defusion, where you create or sense a kind of space that exists between you and your thoughts. But a lot of the time we don't see that space. And Zazen really is a process which allows us to open up that space and see that there is a choice that comes in for us when, in terms of how we respond to our desires and aversions. Master Hong Zhe, another great Chinese master, he talked about taking a backward step. We can learn to do that in our minds, to step back from our narratives and see them as just that, as stories we're telling ourselves. We generally believe that the way we think about ourselves is how we actually are. We cannot distinguish between thoughts and the reality of who we are. Moreover, we tend to treat ourselves according to whatever subtle feelings we happen to be having at the time. If we're feeling negative, we don't see anything good about ourselves. When we're in a good mood, even a shortcoming is adorable. This projection happens so quickly that we don't usually recognize it. But this subtle feeling is what the passage above calls thought. So when you feel something within, recognize it but don't reify, identify, or solidify it into a thing. Definitely don't build a whole narrative around it. This is the meaning of practicing no thought, amid thoughts. It's learning to have a healthier relationship with our thoughts instead of being conditioned by them. Just a little bit more here on thought. The free flow of our minds is the wonderful dynamic activity of our creativity and intellect. There's no need to stop thoughts. At the same time, it is necessary to develop the ability to be free from thoughts. And the different practices we take up in Zen are very much for this. To bring spaciousness and awareness to our thoughts, rather than just being convinced by them. Move on now to no form, the second of these principles. No form is a teaching on how to relate to the external world. Ordinarily, we grasp appearances and characteristics as discrete things. But there is really not a single thing. Nothing is fixed. There is no fixed objective reality. To transcend form within the context of forms is a teaching on not denying or divorcing ourselves from form, but allowing all appearances and characteristics to be without contaminating them with our projections, ideas, or feelings. So it's like we are wearing glasses with tinted lenses, and we experience the world through those distorting lenses, contaminating things with our projections, our ideas and feelings about them. So you see how this is related to the previous one too. We must engage with the world while at the same time we have no vexations about it. When there's room for improvement, we try our best to improve the world of form. When things need to change, we make the change. But emotional afflictions only lead to more vexations. They can contaminate and even ruin everything we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. Some of you may have seen other series of The White Lotus, which has just come out, the third series come out, and it's really about just this thing, about people living in a virtual paradise, but mostly really completely caught up in their own little hell realms, suffering because they're not seeing what's right in front of them. They're completely immersed in their negative emotions. So we actually can ruin our lives by staying caught up in these emotions. How do we contaminate forms and appearances? We defile them by attaching to them, reifying them as things out there. When we make everything into a thing, everything we touch can become a problem. For example, I have a student who makes a big deal out of everything. Every task she takes on, however small, she makes into a thing. And it's always a struggle, always complicated, because she overthinks things. I have another student, and for him, everything he encounters is not a big deal. Yet because he feels it is not a big deal, all sorts of unexpected things come up and he makes mistakes. Still, that doesn't really bother him. Both attitudes are problematic. Both follow their own ideas about things out there. Both have contaminated the form with their own habit tendencies. these deep notions we have about reality and ways in which we reflexively react to things, whether it's anxiety that comes up, or boredom, or taking it easy, underthinking, thinking, imagining that nothing matters. Gives another example of habit patterns that come up in our meditation. He says, one of the most common forms of conditioning in meditation is to fall asleep when we relax. Trying to be clear, we tense up and give rise to wandering thoughts. To practice no form in terms of seated meditation means to stay relaxed but wakeful, clear but without wandering thoughts. This is what we practice, especially if we're practicing shikantas or just sitting, to find this balance where we're alert and watchful, but at the same time at ease, like a cat watching a mouse hole. Whether in daily life or in meditation, the world of form operates through causes and conditions. All appearances are fluid. How then do we work with the changing appearances of form? How do we live in the world of causes and conditions? And I think this is a question that comes up for all of us from time to time, and especially when the world situation seems so dire. What about injustice, discrimination, wrongdoing? He says, the wrongs of the world must be corrected. Each thing is exactly how it's supposed to be through the workings of causes and conditions. Let me just repeat that sentence and let us look at it a little. Each thing is exactly how it's supposed to be through the workings of causes and conditions. I think what he's saying here is that once something has happened, you can't really argue with it. It's happened. Causes and conditions have brought it to that point. Everything comes into being through causes. Nothing arises without a cause, and then conditions determine how it manifests. So in that respect, we don't have any true choice about whether we like it or dislike it. It is. It is thus, and therefore we have to respond. It's not that we have to like it or approve it, but that's how it is. And what can be most helpful, if we are working with something, is to look at the causes, to investigate what conditions and causes brought what we're experiencing, encountering, into being. We need to engage with causes and conditions if we are to better the world. Causes and conditions are about relationships. That's why we sometimes call the world of causes and conditions the relative world. It's about relationships, just as the precepts we take are about relationships, how we relate to ourselves and others. In working with various relationships, we have to recognize, adapt, wait, and create the right causes and conditions for change. Otherwise, emotional reflections will follow our every move. We can get up and caught up in just thinking that we want things to be a certain way. We want the world to be better in this way or that, without seeing that time and relationships have their own rhythms to them, their own ways of unfolding, and we have to respect that, not force the situation. We're seeing a lot of that at the moment, of leaders forcing things in many different ways. But there, we can be sure that there will be many reactions to that forcing. Affliction will follow if you try to go against the unfolding of things. We're not talking about being passive here. In fact, we could say that working with causes and conditions is all about active nonviolence. Nonviolence is a positive force. Working with causes and conditions also includes relating to people. If we want peace and harmony, we must recognize or expose our discriminations. For example, if you interact with people different from you and become vexed, then that's the indicator that you're attached to some kind of form. In our own discrimination and xenophobia, whether conscious or not, we assume that our own perception of the world and of people is the standard of truth. Believing that certain people are different from us, we shun them. Yet evidence shows that it is precisely when we have more interaction across diverse groups of people that we have more ideas, more productivity, and tolerance. Large cities with the highest number of migrants have the highest level of open-mindedness, but the reverse is also true. So in order to advance peace, harmony, and prosperity, we must also adapt or change our viewpoint and create more cross-cultural exchange programs, enable the circulation of different ideas, and have a willingness to connect with others in order to appreciate the benefits of diversity. This is formless practice as it relates to the causes and conditions. In her book about nonviolence at work, Kit Miller talks about having a kind of cultural humility of approaching our interactions with people of different cultures, races, and so forth, that we approach it with a mind of not knowing, a mind of listening. And also we need to have a tolerance of not knowing what the right way or the norms are in a different culture, not just applying our own norms. Tolerating uncertainty, also a tolerance for not knowing our way, not being able to control the situation. To recognize, adapt, wait, and create the right causes and conditions is practice. There's no room for self-centeredness. We have to recognize the workings of causes and conditions, adapt and wait for the opportunities, and create the right conditions for change. The right timing is also important. Change occurs with time. Sometimes only the right person or people can cause changes. You look at history and recognize this. whether it's in the 20th century, Gandhi or Dr. Martin Luther King. More recently, we could say Jacinda Ardern was the right person at the right time. We often don't know how things are going to unfold, but to see, have a long view. This is something we can really learn from Māori, who think in terms of the effects of their actions over generations, generations that came up before them and the ones that will come after them. The Platform Sutra's phrase, to transcend form within the context of forms, can be applied to our own lives and to our socio-political life. We have to recognize, to adapt, to wait, and to create conditions, the conditions of our lives. In this process, if we attach to our own ideas, whether we're pro-change or pro-status quo, the outcome may be more divisiveness. But if we make our socio-political life part of our practice, free up our ideological fixations, recognize and work with causes and conditions, we learn to be free amid the myriad of forms. We learn to be free amidst the myriad of forms. To not attach to form, we must practice no thought, which means being more open to new ideas and less rigid about our own opinions. When we expose our own subtle fixation to thoughts and ideas, we will be able to work with form. If we're thinking that the world out there is unjust without seeing what's going on inside us, then we may be simply contaminating the world of form with our own attachments. So the work we do, the introspective work we do on ourselves and on our thoughts can be very helpful in our relating to people in the world. We may be a little less attached to feeling that we're right or that we know the answers. Well, we haven't got on to non-abiding, but our time is up, so perhaps we can work that third part into a later teisho. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.
The teaching you have received is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of this podcast service or learn more about practice opportunities at the Auckland Zen Centre, please visit www.aucklandzen.org.nz.